Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled St. Paul, a close new formalist reading. And it is about the new Endless Mike and the Beagle Club record, St. Paul, which is coming out in March?
March 4th.
March 4th, that's so insanely soon.
That's very soon.
Yes, yes. And for our guest for this episode is someone who knows a little something about the Endless Mike and the Beagle Club record, St. Paul. Actually, Mike Miller, who is Endless Mike. Mike, thank you so much for doing this again after a million years.
Yeah, dude, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, always a pleasure. So, like I said, the methodology for this podcast, yes, mm-hmm. This methodology. See, your wife just, you know, did the dissertation proposal defense thing today to mark the occasion. Let's talk methodology.
Let's.
For this close reading, I was thinking about certain moments on the album that encapsulate, I think, the spirit of the entire work and things that I find interesting, compelling, and meaningful in it.
Okay.
That's what I was going to do.
That's a close reading.
That is a close reading, and I would...
It's also going to be the only reading I've heard of it, because nobody's heard it.
Oh my.
Not really. I mean, other than people who have been, you know, who are on it.
On it.
Involved in it, or whatever.
Oh my. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, I do. I feel really special all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And I'll say, to go even further with that, so, okay, Douglas Copeland, I don't know if this is still the case, but he went through a period where he did not read any reviews of his novels.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that even the good ones felt like just the meat being ripped off of his back.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, before we get to the close new formalist reading of the record.
Sure.
There is going to be some unpleasantness. This is going to be unpleasant, and I am going to now proceed to rip every morsel off of your spine, okay? and it's my podcast, and those are the rules, and you're just going to have to deal with that, okay?
Fair enough.
Okay, so, wow, the record... So he sent me the link and I got it and I put it in my car and I was driving around town and by about the fourth song, it's this thing, it's just a CDR to me. It's not a real thing. So what is the fourth song on that record?
Try to see your life as a whole.
Whole, yes.
With a W.
Yeah, I honestly started tearing up. It really got to me. It really profoundly affected me, and in fact, I listened to it three times today to prepare for this. I find it so good, so compelling, and the thought that I might be like the one person outside of the Beagle Club AF Records family to hear it now makes me feel like
I have the
great secret of humanity. I am utterly stunned by how good this record is.
Wow.
It's my number one slot for best record of 2016. It's already filled. Let's see if anything knocks it off.
Oh my.
I described it to someone else who pre-ordered the record, and he's like, oh yeah, Winter Westmont, that was pretty good. They just released that track. And I said, it's me, it's the only, it's so exciting. Forgive the sports metaphor. It's the trade deadline deal to get the superstar for the team that's going to try to win the championship. It's that urgent and interesting to me and compelling that I'm just like, wow, these guys are going for it on this record, you know? And when you told me this is, you recorded it three times, right?
Two and a half times.
Two and a half times. I just was like, oh, yeah, this is it. This is... You know, R. Crumb has that, you know, thing in the documentary. He liked old-time blues records in 78s because it felt like those people were just trying to make their mark on the universe. You know, it's the cave paintings in France of just people's handprints. Just, you know, 30,000 years ago, somebody saying, I was here. And I think, yeah, the record does that. It has that quality for, you know, this is... you know, the band shouting at the sea and the tide coming in and trying to stop it. You know, I mean, it just has that people against eternity quality that I kind of dig. It's kind of fun.
It's awesome. And I you know, just what do I say to that?
I know! That's why it says unpleasant, you know? It's just, I've stripped you naked on awesome. A podcast.
And thank you so much for saying
oh,
that.
Oh, you're welcome.
This could have went either way. That's the first guy to hear it. It's like, yeah, you're the first guy to hear it, and we did this before, right? We did the
Yeah,
the
we did it at the old house. It was
a while ago, and you've been since saying, hey, when do you want to come back? When do you want to do this again? I thought,
yeah, so
well, okay, let's do it for real, and that's what, you know, what, the last time I saw you. Why don't we do... Why don't we talk about the record? I'll send you the record. We can talk about it.
Yeah.
That should be the time I'll talk about the record. Yes. We can talk about whatever you want on it. Whatever. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So this really... You being the first guy to hear it, I mean, this really could win me away.
Yeah. So that's wow, like, I feel...
All right. So I'm going to rip the bones out of your back. This record sucks. Yeah. Wow. It really did rip the...
Yeah. Isn't it awful? I mean, it is, you know... Yeah, no, it really moved me. It really just blew me away, you know, just being stuck in traffic on Center Avenue on a 1997 Chevy Cavalier going, oh my God, you know, this, wow, I'm just, you know, so, yeah, chuffed by the whole thing. It's so good.
Really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, and I know when I saw the Beagle Club play at Roboto a few weeks back, you kind of made the joke, I think, before playing Winter in Westmont, oh, this is the next hit we're releasing. There are legitimate hits on this record. I mean, it's not going to be Hotline Bling, you know, in a wonderful world. I love if this record gets to... But there are hits. There are songs that will... kind of own people and own people's earbuds and cascade through the ages on this record. It's just that good, people. It's just that good, which I think...
Thank you, brother.
You're welcome. You're welcome. My absolute pleasure. My absolute pleasure. Yeah, so I think, and maybe this is the place to start then for me with this close reading... is I think the linchpin for the record, and I might be wrong, but thanks to Roland Barthes, the author is dead and I can say whatever I want, even if you're sitting across from me. I think the song that encapsulates this record for me and the whole thing sort of explodes and ripples out is Monitor.
Oh, yeah?
Is the song Monitor.
Okay.
You know, and I think, you know... the way that the song is embedded in time and memory, you know, like with the lyric, I think there's no such thing as the good old days, only the days when we were somehow more, even more unaware, and then go into a memory.
Right.
You know, I think is that, and, you know, this sort of way that, you know, St. Paul, the story of St. Paul, which is track two of the record, right? Yeah. Is a conversion narrative, and in the 19th century, in American lit, actually, the major popular, like, literary form was the conversion narrative.
Right.
Like, all Protestant homes would have these narratives, and in one way, it's proselytizing, but more importantly, the telling of the narrative is reaffirming, this is who I am. And I think that record, that song totally...
With Monitor?
Yeah, with Monitor.
Cool.
Absolutely. And even now, thinking about the lyrics of listening to my friend's unreleased demo, and it moves me more than anything here should be allowed. It's like, yeah, I got to have that. Thank you.
That's a specific, it's about a band called Technological Epidemic. My buddy Chris Bell wrote all the songs for, and some of my very good friends were in that band. And was that and this guy that I know named Dallas Zimmerman, who never finished... a record that he was working on a long time ago. Those are the specifics I'm talking about there. But it's everything I hear. I mean, like, all I listen to is, like, stuff from the 90s and my friends' bands. Like, that's all I listen to anymore, you know? It's just, like, stuff that I get on tour and my friends' bands and what they're working on is really what I care about. And I guess in that, if it's going to the conversion narrative and stuff like that, right, that it's supposed to be... converting you back to yourself, right? bringing yourself back into the present, where you are in the present, instead of worrying about where you're going to be or what happened. So, you know, you listen to your buddies and they're still going for it. They're killing it. It makes you want to get up.
Yeah.
Kill it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's like any moral system, whether I think it is being good at music or punk rock or whatever, you know, it is like Christianity, that it's a goal, really. It's a goal you try to achieve. And maybe in your better moments, you're in the moment.
That's
you're there.
Such a hard thing to explain, why the Christian metaphor and the conversion that's so recurring on that record, it's such a hard thing to explain that it's talking about punk rock the whole time whenever it talks about that kind of stuff. So I hope that this whole thing isn't just me interjecting and being like, oh, thank God. Thank God that was clear.
Yeah.
Thank God he got it. Maybe people will get it.
He's got it. I mean, and I think
that's totally what it is. That's totally exactly what it's about.
Oh, yay! You know? Yeah. Well, I have my doctorate, you know. Anyway. Oh, geez. But no, and I think there is, I mean, there's a richness and a depth, and I think, you know, this methodology for the podcast, I think really works really well, because I think the music, the whole album is so aesthetically consistent. You know, in terms of the sound, but also there are these like bits and bytes that kind of speak for the whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's not an Odd Duck on this record. There's not a song, album, you know, like even some of my all time favorite albums. Like, I mean, Spring Is Coming, and I have this ritual. Every spring, I open all the windows of the house and I blast the XTC album Skylarking as loud as my speakers can handle, and I hope my neighbors are at work.
Is Dear God on that one?
Yes, that's the one with Dear God on it. But also that's really Super Supergirl.
Yeah.
And that one sometimes it catches me weird. It's sometimes that one catches me weird. Sometimes I feel that Supergirl. One, sometimes I don't. Yeah, that song. It's so perfect to me. But it's like, and this record, I think, is just so consistent. It has that. And it also has, I think, that amazing line at the end. You know, and when I thought I'd never find a world deserving of salvation, I came home to my wife asleep with a baby in her arms. I mean, that, you know, is like, there's also this incredible, you're talking about, like, your friends, and that's one of the cool things now, I think, about music, though, you know, maybe people don't get rich anymore, which is unfortunate, or at least make a living wage on it, which is really unfortunate. But people, at least, I think, there's this incredible intimacy that has replaced, like, where you do, you know, talk to people and what are they into, or if you go to a show with someone you like and they bring someone they like to open for them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that to me is so much more compelling than, you know, $100 ticket to see something in the Console Energy Center. Like, I've never actually been to an arena concert.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I could exist in that world.
Right.
But, you know, Roboto, Black Forge Coffee House, where I'll be in a little bit, and actually so will you, strangely enough. You know, like, that makes complete sense to me, and it's really compelling and warm, and so, yeah, so for me, Monitor is the linchpin of that record. That the entire record, by the time I get to that, like, all you go through all this emotional journey and stuff and things, and the kind of the gospel song and all of that, and then you get to that, and for me, that locks the whole thing in, and the record just explodes from there.
Cool. It's the first song on side B of the record.
Mm.
So, it opens up the second half of it.
Ah, I see. Yep. It's Which the midterm review.
There was a lot of, like, where's that one going to go? And the idea was to put, if we put it first, that it would, I don't know if we're really analyzing, right?
Yeah, we are analyzing. Let's go deep, man. Let's.
If we put it first on the second side, that there's your chance to. There's sort of an up and a down on both sides of the record.
Yeah.
Where the first half starts big and you want to charge at the world, take on the world. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And slowly as it goes through the songs, it sort of works through to where that same world closes in on you. And then the next... So that's the first five. And then it's on side B, it starts in a small, closed-in world and moves back to being bigger. So that's why Monitor's first on the other one. It's sort of like a peak and valleys. The whole record's shaped in a V.
Oh, I like it, yeah. So then
with
if you're
Monitor down here, and then it moves itself back up. Even though that last song is the quietest song, it still gets back to putting yourself back out there. Makes sense?
It absolutely makes sense. It makes me wonder why I've been, you know, like today I listened to it on repeat. Like, so let's go back on the loop.
It's exactly what it would do. So yeah. The one that, if it's, when it ends, if you did listen to the record again, or if you were listening to it on a CD and it would just start over again, it would be the same. It would always just peak, valley, peak, valley, yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. So, I mean, so did you think, I guess, so there was some care thinking about, like, sequencing... Mm-hmm. Song selection as well?
Not really. Maybe a little bit. But sequencing, I think, more than any other record we did, we put a lot more time into it, thinking about which one was going to go where. Because the old ones, I would write them all, any other records, I'd kind of write them all in, like, small bursts, and I'd kind of know where it was going, you know? And it would just, it seemed more common sense. It seemed like, oh yeah, well, that's where that one goes. But with this one, that wasn't the case. And there were also other people involved that we weren't, that we hadn't worked with before. You know, had opinions about them too. So it made us really have to be sure that we knew what we wanted to do and why we wanted to do it.
I see.
I guess, like, we were very intentional. With all those choices, yeah. Song selection, though, they were mostly, you know, I wrote them, and I knew that was the record.
Oh, wow. So, what was the first song you wrote?
For that?
Yeah.
First one. Well, In Like a Lion is an old song.
Okay.
It was on a 7-inch before, years ago. But it was always one of my favorites, and I never felt like it got a very fair shake. Like, not enough people heard it.
So I see. I have notes. Wait, I should have. I made a mistake. I did not In Like a Lion, Out Like a Light.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I have notes. Sorry, I annotated the lyrics and those encapsulated pieces. So let's talk about that one. Then.
Okay.
Let's talk about that one. And how? Yeah. I mean, I think so. Because I'm thinking of. You know, you saw the best minds of your generation destroyed by madness. I saw the best of mine destroyed by part-time jobs and student loans. Oh, my Lord, that is so the life of friends, especially of mine. There's so many people I know who have such incredible gifts.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the generation of debt, the pedagogy of debt. Mm-hmm. You know, but they can't make the time to do it because they got dues to make on time. And how... my note is, my two notes are 2016, that just, like, I'll remember, you know, the record of time and place. Yes, this is a thing. And it also made me think of another quality of the record that sort of, we can say, explodes out from these lyrics, or that song, is last fall I taught the great, great, great Margaret Atwood novel, Oryx and Crake. The first of the Mad Adams trilogy, which supposedly HBO is going to do. So Oryx and Crake is going to be the new Game of Thrones in a couple years or something. So get ready for that, kiddos. You buckle up. You're in for a treat. And I guess waving blue penises also. Yeah, sure. as happens in that novel. And there's a scene in the latter, without giving it away, there's a scene in the latter day part of the novel where this new society and these new beings were created, and some things are happening, and there's their world is kind of in flux, and the narrator sees that they've made art
Okay.
And Crake, who is the creator of these new beings, he's like a genetic engineer, mm-hmm. says, you know, once you know, once they start making you art, you know you're in trouble. You know the world is over. You know. And I keep thinking about that, and again, what I
what
felt.
Make?
What do they make? They make a. They meant to make like a scare. It looks like a scarecrow, but it was like their like statue of a person, cool. Like their you know first attempt at you know the Greek marble thing, but it's just with you know rocks and twigs and stuff.
Cool.
And they did it at a moment of crisis. You know, because they didn't know what to do, and they're like, well, what if we make this symbol, and maybe this person will come back, and whatever, and I'm speaking vague, I don't want to ruin the novel, everybody should go read this novel, it's great, but he says, you know, and I'm thinking, too, about how good art, there's a fault line, you know, that maybe what... you know, embed something or maybe captures the public imagination because maybe it speaks to that fault line in a society and a time and a place and what that tension is and maybe speaks to and reveals that tension. Or maybe even, I think, for some people, speaks back to that tension. So I think that's a moment in that song where I can say, yes, the rest of the record does that.
Cool. Yeah, that's that is everybody's story, right?
Yeah. Pretty much.
And I mean, you know, our band is a band where, like, you know, we have a big old band, and hey, are you going to come on tour this time? And as we get older, it's less and less people saying yeah.
Yeah.
Less and less people that can say, hell yeah, I'll drop everything to go play in somebody's basement in Georgia. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, you can't be mad about that, man. You can't be mad about that.
Yeah, because people.
So, you know, that's it. It is something that, yeah. That's weird that you said Margaret Atwood. She wrote a book called Debt. Have you read it?
Not yet.
Do you know about it, though?
Yes, I do.
It's non-fiction, right? It's just her reflection on debt and what it means to be in debt and what that does to, like, your soul, basically. Yeah. I read that book before I wrote that.
That's spooky. Right? Right, terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, it was part of the inspiration for that. It's wow. A song that is about debt. And it was that, and I had read an essay about how banking and loans and whatever could exist in an anarchist society, and then I read Margaret Atwood's Debt, and then I listened to a lot of Springsteen's first record, and that's what you get.
That's what you get. Okay. Yeah. I could keep going. Is there any particular songs that you want to talk about that are particularly for you, like, meaningful, or...
I want to talk about them all, man. I don't talk about them all. They all do work together, like you said, but they are also supposed to stand alone, too, so whatever you want to talk about, man.
Yeah, so actually, can we go then perhaps back to, well, can we go to St. Saul?
Yeah.
Which does keep the rule, right? The no title track rule.
It sure does.
Yeah. Barely. Barely. It kind of rolls around the rim before it falls in, you know? It bounces up there above the hoop.
I think there are two title tracks.
Two title tracks.
Well, sort of. Even though they don't say St. Paul, right? And the only time St. Paul is directly mentioned is the city of St. Paul.
Oh, that's right.
In the Road to Unmasking. So, the Road to Unmasking and St. Saul are the two kind of, you know, they would be the title tracks if you were allowed to make a title track record. Which you're not. It's not cool. It's just not
it's
cool.
It's not cool. It's not cool.
You
it's
don't like, do that. What's the matter with you, right?
It's like wearing the band t-shirt to right? the show, don't, right? You don't do that,
don't
right?
Don't do that. Don't yeah. be that guy. Right?
And they are back-to-back.
They are back-to-back.
Okay.
They are... Okay. Saint Saul was written last on the record.
Almost really?
Last. Maybe almost last. Maybe why? Well, this is the first time I made a record where I did like edit through it and try to make it more cohesive. I think the rest of the not in like a concept record kind of way, but just in a like we hadn't made a record in 8 years. It'll be 8 years when this comes out.
Wow!
But when we started putting it together, it had still been like 5 years, you know, and I was, if we're going to do it again, it should be good. So, we kind of went through it, and I would kind of re-edit and think of them as a whole work and put it together. Try to, pretty much just everything I know how to do at those songs. There's a couple songs on there that I used everything that I know how to do.
This is what I mean. The superstar trade at the trade deadline. We're gonna win the World Series this year. Or die trying.
Yeah, and I want the guys that played with me in the Beagle Club to want to be part of it again. So I wanted to write really good songs so that they'd want to play them. And then we had more time than most of the times of other records we made, where we tried it a few times, recorded it once in my house, and thought it was pretty okay, and we were starting to finish it up, but then that's when Christo and AF Records joined in on it and was like, well, I'll put it out, and we can, and I said, okay. He's like, do you want to use that recording, or send me what you got, and I did, and I didn't hear from him for a while, and I thought, I don't know, whatever. And there was another thing that we were talking to about putting it out, so by then I was kind of like, we didn't finish it at my house, so I was like, well, let's just start all over again. And this time we'll just do it, like, faster, now that we know how to play these songs better. And just do it, see what happens. And we didn't even get a third of the way. We got, like, halfway through it before. Then Steph called and was like, let's do it at our studio. So that was the third time we did it. So we had more time than usual to think about these songs and put them together and stuff like that. So one of the things was, as I was putting it together and knowing about that I wanted there to be the St. Paul narrative, and I wanted it to link to the city of St. Paul and the Republican National Convention and the riots that happened in St. Paul in 2008, which I was a part of. So I wanted it to be a part of that too. And as I'm putting it together, there were a few of my friends and people, like, in the Beagle Club that were like, you're gonna have to tell me what that means. I don't know the St. Paul story. Don't give a shit. Don't know what it is, what I mean?
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, fair enough. So that song was really just written in one way, just to be, like, exposition. And to you. And because I thought it'd be fun to play a song that sounded like that. When I sent the demo.
Oh, yeah.
I sent the demo to the band, and Cody wrote back to me, and he was like, I think we can pull this song off. I think we could get away with it, is what he said. I think we could get away with playing a song like that. And I thought that was pretty cool. I'm going to try something different.
Yeah.
And play a song sounding like that. So what else are you going to sing about,
Yeah, and so it's exposition. It's also then functions as metaphor. Yeah. Or metonym.
Yes.
Yes, that's what we're talking about, metonyms. And I think...
Right, it's supposed to... Hopefully some of the other stuff is a little more... when it talks about St. Paul... In Monitor, we were talking about Monitor, and when I take a shot at St. Paul in Monitor, it's supposed to sort of all go together. And maybe you think back to St. Saul or whatever. That was one of the things with sequencing. It was next to the last at first, and then we thought it would be, I think it was Matt's idea, that was like, it should be second, it should be right out of the gate, and that way it's not a lead up to it. It sort of influences the way you take in the rest of the record. The very first time you hear it, the second song is the biggest one on it, the biggest, loudest, the biggest sound, goofiest one.
Yeah.
With a choir and that direct of the whatever, Instead of making that so that you spend the whole record talking about this metaphor of St. Paul and conversion and sense of identity, losing your identity to something.
Yeah.
Wanting to be kind of letting yourself get carried away.
Yeah.
With your mission, and does that do more harm than good in the world? Good?
Yeah. Because, there is these, again, I think there's also these great collisions, of opposing forces that is nice. And maybe, again, the way this record speaks to sort of fault lines.
Yeah.
And the line, in that blinding new light, he found a new identity, a brand new home for all zealotry.
Yes.
And just that it's change, but not. Yeah. Do people really grow, or they just become more so?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. It's everybody, without exception, should be a part of something bigger than themselves, whatever it is, right? Otherwise, I think, what are you going to do?
You know?
You have your organized with the adjuncts. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of stuff. You know, you're doing this thing, you're doing this podcast. You know, and I'm playing a band, and you know, everybody should be part of something bigger than themselves. However, right? You can sort of, if that you come to define yourself by all by one thing, is there anything left to you? Is there anything, if you take that one thing away, is there anything left to you?
Yeah.
And in 2008, when I went to the Republican National Convention protests in St. Paul, Minnesota, I was at the height of my defining myself as being in this band. We had just put out We Are Still at War. We had been touring 150 shows a year for the last 3 years. Felt like things were going somewhere. I was also at the height of my interest in radical politics and defining myself as that. It was very hard line, very hard on the people around me about it, very hard on myself about those things. These things had come to completely define me. Almost, you know, I'm driving to the protests, and the irony of the name of the city isn't lost on me, and I think, I want to come back from here different. I want to get knocked off my horse and come back different from this, you know? And sadly, I think the way that it happened was, I was taking part in this anarchist black bloc that was supposed to shut down the thing, and obviously that didn't happen, right? Mm. And there's a lot of reasons why that didn't happen, but it was a long drive back. It was a long, lonely drive back, you know? Saying, what am I doing? What am I doing? I still, you know, is this ego? Is this so I don't have to, you know, turn the microscope inward? You know, is this whatever? And that's why we stopped for all those years. It was part of the reason why we did. The other part was because, you know, a lot of those guys didn't want to play with me as much anymore because those were the only things I cared about.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of going to be a drag and things were just getting weird and I was just kind of falling apart, so I thought, all right, I'm done, man. I just stepped away from it, and I don't know what's going to be left of me, and I hope that if I do turn that microscope inward, that I hope I still believe in those things, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm not going to do it out of habit. I'm not going to do it because it's what I always did believe in, you know? Let's see where I end up. And, you know, and I made a record about it, I guess.
Yeah, and so then the meaning of that, the idea, you know, I'd rather lose my mind than give away my heart is, you know, I think it's also maybe, it is a fantastic statement of the times, and doesn't it also sort of encapsulate some of that, there's still that radicalism there?
Oh yeah, like I said, I mean, I've come back to the same thing. I don't not believe, I think I'm, those things that were important to me are more important than ever, but there's also a balance to it to where, you know, it's not the only thing I care about. And it's not the only thing, and it's not in a dogmatic kind of way. It's in a pragmatic way. It's in a, how do we get things done? You know, how do we make this matter?
Yeah.
Kind of way. That line too, the one you just said from Rodin Mask, that's sort of that, was it Churchill? If you're not a Democrat, or if you're not a liberal, in your 20s, you don't have a heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're not a conservative when you're in your 30s, then you don't have a brain.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Was that Churchill?
I think that was, yeah.
It's kind of making...
Somebody will Google it.
It's kind of a shot back at that quote, too.
Yeah. Which, and I could totally understand that. I mean, when I was in graduate school, you know, it was the era of, like, Terrell Owens and Chad Ochocinco. And I started saying to people, like, I can totally understand why they're insane. Like, and I said, it's the same thing. Being an athlete in a PhD program, it's the same thing. Like, you have to just love this one thing so much that will never love you back.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never love you back, but you have to love it so much
and
kind of sacrifice your whole life to it. And, I mean, I had someone sort of in my grad student cohort who just shattered. I mean, just mentally shattered in the pieces. I don't know if they ever got back together. Because they had overdeveloped one part of their life and one aspect of the human existence so much.
Absolutely.
And the rest was just withered on the vine.
Yeah, that's common in... That is common. We were talking about Laura's doctorate. She's working on that. I mean, that's common in grad studies. It's common in doctorate studies, right? It's common with athletes, like you said. Mm. It's super common in activism and activist circles, you know? I think it probably is with punk rock, but most punks only hang out with other punks, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't really care.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I have a person who's actually defending in March, and she's making some of the same bad decisions I made with my life and how I managed my health and stuff. Like, she's, like, doing the same stuff. And I'm trying to tell her, like, don't do this. But maybe she has to. I don't know. But I'm thinking then of, you know, the try to see your life as a whole, WHOLE, which we have to talk about, like, why... The two spellings. That maybe, do you come out of it as then an autobiography writer who doesn't need to explain himself to anyone?
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, again, it's this incredible collision of, you know, you're in the process of this incredibly intimate record that is all about all this exposition.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like, I don't need to explain this to anyone.
That's the joke, right?
That is the joke, but I think there is that sort of antinomy, that kind of opposing forces, I think, for anybody who puts anything out there. You know, I'm working on, there's a poetry manuscript that, like, five things into the future, I'm totally going to work on that thing. And it's because I finally got to the point where, like, I don't need it. People are going to buy this book, I guess, maybe. $5 somewhere.
The line
that's I don't care. Yeah. You know, and I needed to get to that point. So I see how, you know, and especially you have to have that for some of the things that you do say and you do share on this record. Like, you have to have this conviction and self-confidence and comfort. And it just is necessary to do something like this, I think. I don't know if somebody in another place could make a record like this. And I think that line for me is, like, again, it's one of those, it encapsulates something that I think works through the whole album.
It comes out as a line, I'm a selfish freedom fighter, mm-hmm. right? Same idea, right? This dichotomy kind of thing.
And aren't we all?
Right. And to be both, and to, you know, if you really are supposed to explain who you are as a person, I mean, that's Douglas Copeland again. No, it wasn't Douglas Copeland. Tom Robbins. There's two kinds of people in the world. Those who think there are two kinds of people in the world, and then everybody else. Right? There are two kinds of people in the world. Those who think there are only two kinds of people in the world, and those who know how ridiculous that is to say that there's only two kinds of people. Tom Robbins.
I prefer the Pink Flamingos.
Okay.
There's only two kinds of people in the world, Miss Sandstone, Miss Sandy Sandstone.
Well, that's
my kind of people and assholes. And it's clear what category you call it.
Clear.
Yes.
Yeah.
But which is the same thing, but God, I love that movie.
Yeah, man. There was something on there, and now it must be pretty tame. We must have gotten used to it, but there was something on there that when we were recording it, Chris Barker was like, just say it. Just go for it. I can't remember what it was, but it was something that was pretty arrogant. And he was like, fucking just say it. Just go for it. It's awesome. I must have gotten pretty used to it, because I can't remember what that line even is now. But there's something on there that there was a scaled back version of it where he was like, nah. Just swing just for the
say
fence.
It. Just say swing it. For the just fence. Be it. Yeah.
Just, if you already think it, you know, just say it. Just like, say it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it helps to not think about, or to not really worry about that people are going to, you don't think much about the people who are going to listen to it. You don't really owe it to anybody. When we started to play some of these songs out live one time, this guy at a bar was like, yeah, my brother was talking about it. He was like, I really, you know, I was telling him I heard some of the new stuff. I really liked it. And he was like, yeah, I don't know. He's singing about his kids. He's singing about whatever, you know. It's all right, but, you know, he used to sing songs for everybody. Now he's just, you know, singing about himself or whatever. And I didn't have to say anything because Matt was there, too. My brother Matt was there, too. And he was like, we never sang about anybody but
ourselves. Yeah.
You know? It's like, that's okay. That's cool. But it's not, I don't think it's come from anywhere any different, you know?
Yeah.
And the trick to that is to just not really think much about that anybody's going to hear it.
Yeah, but they do. But, and so then, thinking about...
One person, to be one specific. That's
it. Me! It's you! It's me! For the next, like, week and a half.
Yeah.
You know, wait, 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
2 weeks? Next 2 weeks? This is my...
It's all yours.
It's all mine. It belongs... That's so incredible. I cannot... I mean... I had a friend, he passed away. I was actually thinking about it. He was one of the people I wanted to have on this podcast.
Yeah.
And he died. You know. He was actually, he was a Franciscan priest. I met him through people when I was at St. Francis. Mm-hmm. And he met the Pope once. And I remember, Pope John Paul II. And I remember when Pope John Paul II was passing away, like when they were saying, you know, they were covering it on CNN. And so you got to watch him. We all got to watch the Pope die on CNN, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he just got drunk that afternoon. Like he couldn't deal with it. And he said about how, like when I met him and he talked to me, they talked. And he said, I felt like I was the most important person in the world for those 5 minutes.
That's cool.
You know, and it's nice. And so I had a little taste of that. But, you know, to go back to that, you know, I'm the most important part in the Beagle Club world.
I wasn't how you were going to bring that back around.
But, I got a secret. It's called St. Paul. You can't have it yet. Anyway, so, but then it comes back to then the lyric in See Your Life as a Whole, H-O-L-E,
mm-hmm.
right? Is that the one? Is that the second one? Yes. I stapled this too. I should have stapled this and I should have numbered the tracks. Next record when we do this,
okay.
I will totally know, or I will just tape to the wall.
You're doing great. I know I'm doing great. Don't worry about it.
But do they? But do the people on the other end of this cord that's plugged into this computer?
Yeah, they never even heard it.
I know. And then they're going to be like really disappointed probably if they pre-order it and then they listen to this. They're like, man, this guy's like totally, what's he thinking? I don't know. That could happen too, But that lyric, so keep on pushing it down your throat when you keep pushing it out. That sense of insignificance as an American, that sense of insignificance as American is a mushroom cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to me speaks to this sort of young person's cancer that we have, this psychological cancer that a lot of people, I think our generation has it. I think the generation after us working in the lives of 18-year-olds has it so much worse to the point where it might be terminal for their whole lives.
Yeah.
Or in 20 years, wow, are we going to see some midlife crises?
Yeah.
Like it's going to be Dawn of the Dead midlife. Like everybody will just hit it at once.
Wow.
And society will crumble because that, tyranny of perfection that we all live under.
Right.
You know, that, oh, well, I just do this thing. You know, I gave up with my students, I gave up doing intro speeches because they would almost sound like, and some of it was stage fright, but it was also that a lot of kids would get up there and it was like they would apologize for their lives.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm from Shaler. Not a lot happens there. You know, yeah. I got this major. And it's not so
perfection, right? It's like, it's also that there's no, that's good enough, too. I mean, not good enough, but like, it's not that, you said the tyranny of perfection, but it's more that people aren't striving for perfections. Perfections, even as a form, doesn't really, there's no value in that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I guess the way I'm using perfection, I see what you're saying. The way I'm using it is that I think if you have a life that, you know, your socialization, or at least some people's, or their vision of the world or the mirror that holds you back is media. I think that's the thing. We grow up watching movies. We grow up watching TV.
Some of that song, right?
Yeah. I think people look at, you know, I remember as a kid, like, watching some, like, Indiana Jones and going, well, that's never going to be in my life.
Mm.
You know? you know? And I think, I said this to a poet friend once a while back, you know, it's like what happened was we human beings had culture and it was this immediate, intimate thing. People made it, you know, before the recorded record disc, which you should pre-order, St. Paul. I'll put the link on the podcast. You know, get buy records, people. Buy this record. But you think people, if they wanted music, sometimes they had to play it or they had to go see it. Mm-hmm. Or for most common folks, they had to make it. And you commercialize it, whatever, that takes that maybe away from people. It takes away the intimacy of, yeah, going to a coffee house and yeah, seeing somebody with a guitar, and you go, oh, I can, and maybe I can talk to him afterwards or whatever. Or, you know, pay them directly for the record if you want it, as opposed to if you grow up in mainstream media culture. You know, even now, I mean, doing this, doing another podcast with a band called Silence on Wednesday, and their record's not out yet, and they're doing it to promote it. And I was telling a friend the other day, I was like, I remember thinking musicians were these, like, they were like the Loch Ness Monster. Mm-hmm. Like, you didn't see them, you didn't meet them. It was just these rare sightings. Right. And the fact that I have people, you know, like, hey, this is coming out here, here's some MP3s,
yeah,
so I can be on the show and we could talk about it, and I could talk to people who make records. Like, my 16-year-old self would have never thought that was imaginable. Like, yeah, that's not even, like, you know, once you're twice as old as you are now, Matt, you're going to be talking to musicians about their records that you listen to and enjoy. No, that's not possible. So I'm not going to have the Loch Ness Monster as a pet. It just funny doesn't happen.
Two funny stories. When we recorded at Anti-Flag's, like, headquarters, you know, where they have their studio and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Chris number two is behind the board. He's doing his stuff. And they have all their stuff stored there, too. They have, like, their road cases and whatever. And it has Anti-Flag sprayed across it so that, I don't know, so that Pennywise doesn't accidentally take it home with them or whatever.
Yeah.
And we put out, like, an open casting call sort of to a few, like, Facebook groups and stuff and just said, we're making this record. You want to come and be on it? Badass. You know? Get a hold of me and I'll send anything. So we did. So there were people that came down, didn't know what we were doing, didn't know us very well, certainly didn't know where they were coming to. They just showed up in this place, and the one kid's like, come, all these things have Anti-Flag spray painted all over it. And Barker's like, because I'm in Anti-Flag, it's the band I'm in, I play in Anti-Flag. And the guy was like, oh, really? Like, you know. And then the better one was that our friend Jody, who sings in the choir, and she sings on Try to See Your Life as a Whole with an H, she's all, you know, she's on the record, pretty big part of the record. She didn't, you know, she was totally cool the whole time, didn't do anything. And then as she's leaving, she was like, can I ask you something, to Chris? And he's like, what's up? And she was like, I have a picture of you and me that I took when I was 15 years old at Club Laga when I saw you guys. And Chris is like, let's recreate it. So they, like, recreate the picture. So tell that girl, that 15-year-old girl in that picture who's getting her, who wanted a picture taken with Chris Barker, mm-hmm, that she's going to be on a record that he's producing 15 years later, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, you never know, people, where your life is going to end up.
Sure. I can remember listening to Anti-Flag in my buddy's car on the way to school in the morning. So they've been a band for 30 years.
Dude. Yeah, that's right. Damn,
yeah. A lot of people. Well, so, but then, yeah, like you said, just turns out it's actually just people.
Yeah, it does turn out there's just people.
Maybe, and that's kind of a drag, but it's all.
It's not. No, actually, it is, I think, really cool because I think it reclaims something that sure, old model of, you know, I'm just going to download this or see it on MTV, just is lost and maybe deprives people that people. It makes people, as much as people identify with it, as much as it can be pleasurable, it also, I think, makes people feel insignificant sometimes. Yeah. I think it really does. I think it makes people kind of alien to their own lives and their own mental landscape and maybe their own hearts in a weird way.
Yep.
That if you say, hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm from Shaler or Johnstown, mm-hmm, you almost have to apologize for it, mm-hmm, which I guess is another thing. We have to talk about the role of Johnstown in this record. Because Johnstown is a place that's near and dear to my heart. It's where my mother grew up.
Right.
Still have family there. I always had, you know, as a child, my two-week vacation in the summer was in Johnstown.
Riding up and down that incline plane for 2 weeks.
Well, you know, I was afraid I'd, so I didn't ride the incline plane until I was an adult. But yeah, and so the role of Johnstown and the line in Streetcar about, you know, I'm going down to the heart of this whole town, mm-hmm. trying to pump some blood into its veins.
Yeah.
And I think of my own, you know, I come to Johnstown every few months. You know, I drive, you know, 56 through the West End. The house my mom grew up in isn't there anymore.
Right.
Actually, it's the day I moved into this house, an arsonist burned down most of the block that my aunt was living on in that house, yeah. And the house was damaged, and so it's gone. It's a field now where my grandparents lived and my mom grew up, and it's just like buildings just disappear.
Yeah.
But if you look past that, you can see how great it once was. Like, mm-hmm. that there is a greatness to that place.
Absolutely.
And it's still there, but you have to really look for it. And if you know it, it means something, but I think to a lot of folks, it doesn't. Or they would just see it and it's just like, oh, this is just another Rust Belt post-industrial nightmare scape or something, you know, but it's this place that has a beating heart still, I
Absolutely.
Think.
My grandmother used to tell us this story about when she was a kid, she would skip school and just, you could hang out in Johnstown all day. You could hang out downtown. Skip school, and she talked about how she used to jump on the streetcars. You know, you jump on the back of the streetcar so you don't have to pay. But there's a scene in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Mm.
You know Roger Rabbit? You know
the movie
Who
Framed Roger Rabbit? Please!
he's hanging out on the back, and he helps this little... These kids are... The main... It's Bob Hoskins, and he hops a train car. And we watched that with my grandmother, and I remember her saying, I used to do that at Johnstown, and me and Matt would make her tell us stories about her hopping train cars, because it looked so awesome. So there used to be streetcars that ran around Johnstown, and the tracks are still underneath the roads there, man. They just paved them over. That's why it's called Streetcar.
Yeah.
First time you're going to hear on that record that there's not a lot of repeated choruses, so that's one of the only times where the chorus does repeat in the song. And the first time it talks about it, it's absolutely talking about Johnstown. You're right. And the second time it says that, it's saying it to wherever I am, because then it gets into that we're at a show or whatever. So.
Yeah, and that is the second appearance of your grandmother. Grandmother on this record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you tell the story in...
Monitor
about, you know, her bold life decision for the time, the era, and the place. And, you know, I guess that's also part of my love for Johnstown, but realizing that there is that weird insularness that's still there, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people can be really lost and intolerant because of that, you know. And I want to get to, and I think actually you sent me the lyrics. It's not in the lyrics you sent me. The line of Winter in Westmont that I might as well not be an economist.
It's not in there?
It's not in there.
That's weird.
That's weird. But it made me think about, you know, well, let's go back to academic discourse. It is an incredible critique of neoliberalism and the neoliberal era, that it is economy is the only thing, only true measure of worth that we have is whether it promotes, whether it grows jobs, whether jobs, or whatever. And again, like how a place like Johnstown, Westmont, it has a value that people maybe, if you use ESCO, people can't see that value anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
As a place where people lived and...
Right. Westmont's kind of it's on top of the mountain, right? So that when the Johnstown used to flood, they wouldn't get flooded.
Yeah.
And that's why it was like the rich part of town.
Mm-hmm.
But it's totally evened out now. It's not the rich, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's Richland.
Right,
it's the rich land where my uncle now lives.
Which isn't even Johnstown proper.
Yeah, which...
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, my family never made it to Westmont.
Yeah.
There was the story, it was... So they lived in half... My mom grew up in half a duplex in the West End.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a three-bedroom duplex, and there were three girls and two boys.
Okay.
And my grandparents in half a house.
Yeah.
And my grandfather was a steel worker. Oddly enough, speaking of closing the loop, you know, my own... You know, activism, which unfortunately has kind of been on the back burner, which I need to kick it up a notch, I think, get back in the game soon.
You will. You will.
I will. It's going to happen. Maybe this year will be the year I finally get arrested. I don't know. but, you know, there would be the seasonal layoffs and all of that, and the slowdowns and the furloughs. And so the family fear was if they made the leap to Westmont, you know, what would happen if my grandfather was out of work for 6 months? Would they lose the house?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we never made it to Westmont.
Nope. Exactly.
Yeah. Some nice houses in Westmont, though.
There are. But now you can buy them for nothing, is what I'm saying, you know. It's all pretty well evened out.
Yeah. You know, and you think in the outro of that song is, you know, as much as I hate to admit it, Dad, I think I know what you mean.
Yeah.
You know, again, thing exploding from this song that I think, you know, is the way a lot of the themes of the album are very much embedded in right now. I mean, there's notes that I have throughout that are like 2016, 2016, 2016. Then there are these things that are so situated, I think, in right now, and maybe right now even my own life, where it is. But then also speaking of these universals at the same time, you know, because I think a lot of people can just sort of relate to that line, I think, as you know, hit 30-something, right? Isn't that what 30-something's about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've gone back and forth through this record, so I think we have left Intro to Philosophy, right? And we have Player Piano. Is that what's left?
Yeah, probably.
Probably.
Which are just bookends, man, you know? Intro to Philosophy opens it up, and it's gonna, each little verse is gonna talk about a different part that's gonna be further expanded upon as the record goes on. Mm-hmm. You know, the first verse is just about that mundane, and as you said, the tyranny of perfection. It's a good way to put it. And the second one's family, and then it gets into consumerism and nationalism, right? And then the last one's art and personal relationships, and then finally, the very last verse makes it immediate, singing about the record that the song is on.
Yeah.
And then the Player Piano is kind of the closer, man. Yeah.
Well, I find, you know, so Intro to Philosophy is so, it's so urgent. I mean, it you know.
We never opened a record with a fast song before. It's the first record we ever opened with a really fast song.
But this is what I mean.
That was exciting,
like,
to us to do. And there was so much argument, so much more than you would ever think that there would be, about what that single acoustic guitar that opens the record was going to sound like.
Really?
There was so much back and forth between, like, us inside the band, and then, like, with number two about stuff. Like, we just, like, back and forth about it. Like, he was like, he had this, like, distortion on it, which, like, you know, Cody and Davis and, you know, were just like, no distortion, no. You know, and then there's me being like, it's like 8 seconds long, you know, and they're like, you know, it's important. And I was like, that's all right. So it was back and forth. Mm. In the end, you hear it, and then you hear the distortion swell up, but everybody wins, right? But there was so much bitching about that little part. And that's just indicative of the whole record. The whole record was made that way. It was fine-tooth combed. Everything really purposeful.
You know? But it was... It, your suffering has meaning, at least in my pleasure. For the next 2 weeks, when this will be... I'm the only one. I'm the sole survivor. I guess... Well, Danelle's heard it, too. Today, for the first time, 3 times. Today. But I think it's part of that, and what maybe... To go back to my, you know, sitting... stuck on Center Avenue in the Hill District in my car, you know, what got me, what pulled me in 4 tracks into this record was just the incredible urgency of that song and the immediacy of it. And we're not going to wait forever. This is it right fucking now. This is it right fucking now, you know, is just a siren call for, I think, the rest of the record.
And that's the conversion, man. That's the conversion. It's the conversion... is to snap out of where you've been, where you think you're going to go, and to just be beamed into the present, be aware of yourself at the moment. That's the conversion that's mentioned throughout the whole song. And that was the hardest thing for me to learn how to do, and it's something that I still struggle with learning how to do, but has made all the difference. So that's that conversion. That's awesome. I'm glad you picked up on that.
Yeah.
Because... in my my worst fears, it's that the interpretation would be like, huh, I guess they made a Christian record.
Well, you know, it's the key there is for me, I was like, this is an interesting choice. And then I did catch, you know, Brand New Home for All Zealotry and, you know, Found New Identity. Either way, this much is true. He did more, you know, in the name of love and the name of intolerance. I was like, oh, okay, here we go. Here we go. This is... So it's like almost like you get, again, you get the mood, Mm-hmm. And then on the micro level, when it sinks in, you get the meaning. Yeah. It's just so delicious.
Cool, man.
It's cool. Delicious.
There's a line in that song that sometimes that hits a bit too close to home for me.
Mm-hmm. I did highlight that when we didn't get to...
When we were recording that, and we were doing it with the gospel, with the choir and everybody singing, you know, going all out. I remember Chris being like, "All right, do they sing that line? You want the does the choir sing that line?" And I was like, "No, it's that line is no. It's all fun and games until that line. Yeah. That line is just me. That's the reason. That's the line in this song that makes this whole song worth singing." So, yeah. I mean, otherwise it would just be goofy, which it still is goofy. But then
it is goofy, but it's totally so much goofy. Fun. I mean, it's a gospel song, right?
It is, man.
He's just a man.
He was like, "Yeah. We can pull. I think we can get away with this."
But you know, and I think a player piano, I think is, though. I mean, it rises, but it is a quiet song. Mm-hmm. And it's a fairly intimate song. I mean, is that just you playing that one?
Matt plays the bells.
Oh, okay, that's right. There are bells. There are bells.
Cody and number two play the shakers.
Okay.
And then I play the piano and the organ.
Yeah. And the
choir's in it again.
You know, yeah. And then in the end, I mean, and to even, you know, take that line, "Be ashamed to die before you win one victory for all mankind," and problematize it and reaffirm it at the same time is so delicious and is so interesting to me, that again it embraces both of those things so efficiently.
Thanks.
You know, yeah. and I'm thinking about, so we are recording this podcast in a 100-year-old house.
Yeah, beautiful house.
Thank you. It's actually newer than my old house. My old house was built in 1896. This one was built in 1915. But you know, yeah, at some point this will. The thing again, you know, this will just be a place. I recently, actually, for whatever stupid reason, I found my old house on Zillow. It's a rental now.
Yeah.
And they did stuff to it. They painted all the walls white again. And a nice new kitchen, nice new bathroom. Things, if I had stayed there, that's what I would have done to it.
Yeah.
And the new roof it so desperately needed. And they fixed the plaster in the attic and all of that stuff.
Were you renting there before? Did you own that
place? I owned that place. Yeah.
Okay, so that is weird.
That is weird that it's now back to being. Right. It was a rental before I owned it, and it's a rental again.
Yeah,
and
that would be weird.
And to see, like, the Craigslist pictures that they populated of it. And sure. I was just like, oh wow, this is just a place now.
Sad, man.
You know, which is sad and weird, and I had dreams about it.
Yeah.
You know, I still have dreams about the house I grew up in, which is weird. I haven't been there. My parents sold it in 2000. I've been to that town in 2000. Yeah. I still have dreams about this house that is just the place now. Yeah. Which is maybe not the best place to finish talking about this record. There's hopeful things on the record, too. There really is a hope and an energy and a life. But, hey, you chose to end it that way, man. Since that was your sequence.
I think that one ends where it should. And it ends the record really small. Back to just the idea of, you know, one person trying to connect to something bigger.
Yeah.
And saying that, you know, the best I can do right now is connect to where I am right now.
Yeah.
Because that alone is bigger than just myself, you know? Yeah. That's where the record ends. Then it starts over with the first song again.
Yeah, put it back
goes
in.
Goes right back down into
just
that valley.
The record
and
over.
Back up.
Yeah, there you go.
Up and down, man.
Yes. So again, it is. I when I love things, I really love them, and I hope people don't think I'm just being mawkish or I'm trying to kiss your ass or anything. But the record is stunningly good.
Wow.
It's just stunningly good. It's just, I remember hearing the songs you played like a year ago, Roboto, a couple of songs ago. Oh my God, like this is something, you know, and, you know, live PA sound is what it is, you know, and it's good and it's energetic, but to hear it kind of like the, this is how it's supposed to sound is something.
That's awesome. Cool.
You know, and of course we'll put links, on when I post the podcast where they can order this record or they can find out about it. But before we continue this active promotion, it's time for the bottom five.
Yay.
It is time for the bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. We can shift not at all gears related. There. Not at all related to our main topic. All
right.
Are you ready?
Ready.
Ready. This one actually, this might be, actually, you know, I'm going to skip that one because for the one I was going to choose, too close to the main topic.
Interesting.
So I have to think now. The new question one is, what is the strangest injury you have ever suffered? What is the strangest way you've ever been hurt?
You did ask me this the last time I was here.
I did? Oh, yeah, no!
And I don't have an answer. My answer was just like, I don't have anything. It's kind of a boring. I don't have anything.
The bottom five has fallen apart.
It's okay. But, you know, even if you hadn't, my answer would still be that I don't know. I've never really. I mean, you know.
I'm crestfallen.
People want to tell stories about, like, that something's sticking out of their eye. Yeah, remember, because Derek told the story about that his dad.
Yes, which ended up in his book.
Did it?
Yeah, it ended up in remembering everything. Yeah. Oh, wow. What if I planted that seed? Oh, dear Lord. all right. So then let's try this again. Question
Matt
two.
Matt talks about his phantom heel injury.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
See, I should have found those files and did it, but oh, well. Well, Jose, here, question two. This is tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood. That's not even a question. That's a prompt. Here's the prompt. A happy but unremarkable memory of your childhood. So it's not like, we went to Disney World. No. It was raining one day and we baked cookies. That's what I want to hear.
I can remember my grandpa, my mom's dad, Grandpa Fretzel, took me and Matt out for ice cream. And it was super hot out. He drove a Bronco. And it was super hot out and our ice cream cones melted all over his Bronco. And he thought it was super funny. And, like, it was so cool. And I think about it all the time. It was, like, maybe one of the only times we ever spent, like, just us and Grandpa. And, yeah, it was great. I think about it all the time.
That's
melting cool. Orange pineapple ice cream all over his Bronco. I was probably 5 years old.
That's
no
great.
Car seats, just sitting in there. He's like, let's go. You know?
That's how he was, late 70s, early 80s. That's how we rolled back then, yeah.
86, yeah.
Yeah, that's how we rolled, man. No car seats, but that's really sweet. All right, so we're going to change gears now. Question three. What is the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool? What's the strangest thing that's either gone in or come out? Any buttons?
Again, nothing comes to mind.
Oh.
But
the second answer was so great. Bronco ice cream cones.
Yeah, no, nothing comes to mind. Even eating weird stuff. But, yeah, nothing. I don't know. I ate shark once.
Oh, there you go. I've never eaten shark.
Tried shark.
Shark? That's pretty... Shark. Dude, you ate shark. That, right? You reinforce the food chain. You reinforce the food chain. You're
right?
Like, you know.
That's what, give me some of that shark.
The shark. That's how I. That was Jaws, whatever. I ate.
Yeah.
I ate Jaws. Yeah. That's so great.
I can eat shark.
Yeah. Fuck you, nature. Just man, like rules.
Little, people are just trying it.
Yes. All right, question four. Question four, I hope they didn't ask this one last time. Is there anything in your home that you're afraid of?
You did not ask it.
You did not?
Anything in my home that I'm afraid of?
Because I think that's important. I still have a circular saw.
Besides the people that live there.
I don't...
Or I can say them. Nah, I'm not afraid of them. I can take them. My two little kids.
Yeah.
Maybe Laura, but I'm not afraid of her. Unless that'd have to be.
A power.
Jack had, when he was a baby, a learn and play puppy that talked whenever it felt like it.
Ooh.
And it would just talk in the middle of the night.
That was oh, yeah. That's so
it would just be like,
scared.
You know, it's learning time!
It's like,
that was not...
And you know, you think that's like probably a time in your life out. When you're yeah. like, yeah. heavy sleep is bad and impossible anyway.
Yeah.
And then, oh!
Yeah.
Oh, that's so terrible. When
you're sneaking through the house so that you don't wake the baby up and you just hear, it's learning time! Yeah, I'm very scared of the learning play puppy.
Very scared of the learning play puppy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
All right.
To this day, I can't face her. Luckily, Jude, when he came along, had no interest in learning to play puppy.
That's good. Learn to play puppy. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And she sounds like a friend of mine's ex-girlfriend.
Oh.
So, yeah.
There you go.
Like, what are you doing here in the middle of the night? Telling me it's time to learn.
Yeah. Time to learn.
Time to learn.
Yeah, yeah, which, hey, let's keep maybe the horror theme going.
Okay.
With question 5.
Okay.
Have you ever been close to death? Did you learn anything?
Close to death, like, did I almost die?
Yeah. Or even if there was, like, something like, if, you know, I paused at that red light, didn't pause an extra 30 seconds kind of stuff, or, you know.
probably, right? But I thought that my first interpretation of your question was, have you ever been, like, close while somebody was dying? And the answer is yes.
Oh.
And it's my grandmother, who I sing about on that record. Mm. And what I learned from it was that it really seems like you just let go.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't scary and it wasn't weird. It was just, she just let go.
Mm.
You know, or she was about to. So yeah, I learned that.
Yeah.
It was a big lesson.
That's
Don't
huge.
Don't be afraid.
Yeah. No, that's solid. That's good. And that's liberating, too.
Absolutely.
You know, that's liberating to know. Yeah.
Yep.
And you could live the rest of your life then, I guess. It's going to happen. Which is also a theme on the record.
Yeah.
Keep breathing, my friend.
That's it.
There we go. And so, yes, so this record is coming out March 4th. You can pre-order it from?
From AF Records.
And I'll have the link on the thing and... Yeah. And there's going to be some touring. There's going to be stuff. So when people want to find Absolutely. Out about all things Beagle Club, where do they go? What do they do?
That stuff's on AF Records or will be. That stuff is on our Facebook. You know, just look up Endless Mike and the Beagle Club.
Yeah, and I'll have links.
Facebook page and, yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's about it. Our next awesome. Episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. Our last 10 episodes are on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to Brett, as always, for the lovely theme music. And thank you so much, Mike, for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Putting yourself in the analyst chair. Later, meets.